Welcome to the International Order of the Golden Rule podcast series. OGR provides tools and resources to help independently owned funeral homes be exceptional. This episode comes from the Dodge Company, an OGR endorsed supplier. A family owned and operated business since 1893, the Dodge Company is the world's largest manufacturer and distributor of preparation room supplies. Dodge carries a complete line of memorial products, stationery, grief recovery materials, urns, and urn vaults through their partner companies. Dodge supports the Order of the Golden Rule and its members by contributing annually towards the association's educational programming. Dodge believes that education is the key to the future of our profession. To learn more about the Dodge Company and the products and services they offer, visit dodgeco.com.
We've had antique tractors in front of our funeral home, draft horses, motorcycles inside. We do the helicopter in our parking lot, fertilizer trucks. We do things to specialize services for that individual family so that when they are with us, I want them to feel like they're the only people in our minds at that particular time and that they're getting something nobody else gets.
Hello, cast by, for, and about the independent funeral home profession. Our theme this year is the changing consumer, as we focus on how your business can develop and pivot with the needs of your customer. Today we have with us as our guest today, Wallace Wiley Hooker, CFSP, MBIE, a owner, funeral director, an embalmer from the Family and Friends Funeral Home of Wingate, Indiana. Wiley Hooker is proud to serve as president of the Indiana Funeral Directors Association and also will be teaching this year at the 2023 OGR Annual Conference in the Apple. A Hoosier at heart, Wiley grew up on a farm near Francisville, Indiana. He attended Purdue University, graduated of Worsham College of Mortuary Science. Wiley is one of the early recipients of the certification of the Medical Legal Death Investigator and enjoyed 22 years career as Deputy Coroner of Fountain County. Wiley was awarded the distinction of being named a Lifetime Isaac Ball Fellow for his continued support in the Indiana Funeral Education Foundation. We welcome Wiley to our podcast today. Wiley, we welcome you to be here, and we're just so glad to be. I know it's been a rough moment to get here, but we are here this morning.
Good morning. I don't know where you found all of that bio on me, but yeah, I'd forgotten some of that.
Yeah. And I would like to also put in your bio, you're a family man, a father, grandfather, and so I know that's a challenge to do the work and also spend time with the family. But this morning we want to check in and get started. Wiley, you demonstrated through your career such passion for embalming. What drives that passion for you?
I guess, you know, if I go back, way back to my childhood, I remember my parents, my grandparents, neighbors, they would go to a visitation or funeral at the local funeral home, and maybe they would come back to our house or my grandparents or a neighbor's and the kids were playing. But I remember the adults talking about how someone looked like they could just sit up and talk, that they didn't look dead at all. It just looked as though they were sleeping. And I always thought that was odd. And then as we fast forwarded, I was about a junior in high school and two classmates died in a car train accident in our small community. And they were cousins. They canceled school for a couple of days. They had a joint visitation and a joint funeral. And it was at that time that I took an interest in funeral service. And the gentleman that I started working with had a passion for embalming. He had a passion for doing things right. He was pretty outspoken. He was very determined, and he was very good at what he did. And the advice he gave me probably, let's see, over 55 years ago, when I showed an interest and had talked about going to mortuary college, he said, I want to give you some advice. Be nice to little old ladies and little kids. Don't worry about the money. It will always be there. and make sure your bodies look better than anybody else's, and you'll be successful. And that's probably where it came from. And then as time went on and I was involved in funeral service, I worked with a lot of great people that were very good at what they did. I learned a lot from them. I stood beside some people that weren't so good, and I also learned from them. And as I was going through the IFDA chairs, Kurt Rosted called me one day. I'm trying to speed a story up for you. I know you have other questions, but he had heard stories that I was doing reconstructive work for other funeral homes and difficult case embalmings. And he asked if I would do a presentation at our midwinter conference. And that would go back like 10 years. And I thought it was a joke at first, and he assured me it wasn't. So, but I did find out, you know, and it kind of burst my bubble that I was actually filling in for someone that had to cancel. So it wasn't that I was that good. It was that I was available. So when I did lecture, it went well. He shared it with some other association execs. And the next thing I know, I'm on the speaking circuit. And so I kept adding information and photos to my PowerPoint. I was getting permission from families. And I started hearing from other people and families talking about the dreadful work they see going on out there. And with the rate of direct cremations, with the lack of loyalty towards a funeral home anymore, I thought, boy, if we don't do it better, how are we going to hang on to our relevance and to what we do as professional embalmers? That was a long answer to a short question, wasn't it?
That's all right. How important is embalming to the process of grief?
For me personally, from my side of the table and from my other side of the table, when I lost my parents and my brother and nephew, I think it's difficult to say goodbye to someone who wasn't there. When we go to a baptism, we don't expect to see a photo of the infant in the front of the church being baptized, do we? Nor do we go to a wedding and expect to see a photo of the bride and groom at the front of the church and find out they've already gone on their honeymoon. You know, that's part of the process. I just find it difficult for families to find, and I hate to use the word closure, but I think it's the first step on recovery when we're able to take the emaciated, the edematous, the traumatically disfigured by cancer or accidents. If we can take those deceased and make them whole again and make them maybe even better than they were as they were going through the dying process, it gives the family something to remember better than what they saw in the nursing home or the hospital. And by giving them, and I hear it over and over, they didn't know their loved one could look that good. And I'm not bragging about my work. I'm just telling you a fact that I hear it from families that they were so glad that they got to see their family member look that good during the visitation and funeral that it helped them. I think the first thing that I do is when a family comes in, even if they told me at the house, if it's a hospice case, if it's at a nursing home, the family's there, or if the family calls in and notifying me of a death, and they may say, "Dad just wanted a cremation. He didn't want a big fuss." I don't accept that that's the way it's going to be. I have the families come in to make the arrangements, and instead of getting my pen and pad and forms out, you know, we'll have a cup of coffee, a soft drink, and I'll engage the family in a conversation, trying to learn more about their loved one. And you often find that what the loved one may have wanted in the way of their disposition or a service is quite different than what their family wanted. And I try to find that middle ground and actually explain to families that cremation is simply an act of disposition and that a lot of things can happen between death and the cremation process itself. And it's interesting how many people over the years haven't been aware that you can actually have a traditional service and visitation and service prior to the cremation. So I think it's important that we as practitioners who are actually meeting with families step up our game and make sure that families understand what their options are. I've had families come in here, and once I explain that to them give them the information, they've changed their mind about what they wanted to do.
With the new way of thinking of, say, the young film directors coming out of school, and what is your experience in giving other film directors advice in order to better serve them in this day and time?
Are we talking technically, or meeting with families, or running funerals, visitations? What in particular are you asking?
I would say everything, because we face with everything on a different, sometime a little bit of this on one day, a little bit of this on another day, but in the whole gamut of being able to assist families better, what would be your advice?
You know, the first thing is, if they're going to be meeting with at-need families, my advice is listen more than you talk. Mm. Just great. Listen. Families will tell you what they want if you give them the opportunity to talk. Don't go in there and act like you're an accountant or an attorney. Go in there as a compassionate, empathetic funeral director, and get to know these families before you get into the mechanics of arranging the service. Because if you get down on their level and listen to what their needs are, what they personally feel like that they need, they're going to tell you exactly what they would like to have, even if it's a little different than what their loved one suggested that they wanted. And so, as I said, listen more than you talk. In the way of body preparation, as I say, I am 68 years old. Each time I walk into the prep room, I want to be better than the last time. I'm not stuck in any particular way that I do things. Even though I lecture, I go to other lectures. I watch podcasts. I read. I try to up my game. I try new products. If you're coming into this and you're working in a multi-generational funeral home, or you go to work for someone, they're pretty well set in their way of how they do things. And that's not particularly prudent in my estimation, because when I lecture, I talk about, you know, when my grandfather was farming, he farmed with horses when he started his career. He shucked corn by hand. He went to the bathroom in an outhouse. And when he retired and turned things over to my dad, he had tractors. He had self-propelled combines and pickers. And so, see, things change. Just because you've always done something the same way doesn't mean it's a prudent way to do things. There are better chemicals today than there ever has been, you know, accessory fluids, chemicals that help us do our job better with difficult case embalmings. A lot of products are available for doing reconstructive work. And a lot of embalmers aren't availed to those products because owners and managers who are far removed from the embalming room are still ordering supplies without giving their people in the prep room the opportunity to have input or suggest items that they would like to have to maybe make their job easier and to do a better job of preparing bodies. That's one of the things that's really disturbing to me is if you have a good embalmer, and I can't stress this enough, with the shortage of qualified funeral directors and embalmers out there, I just want to suggest to owners and managers, a good funeral director and a good embalmer, they're very hard to find, and they're also very hard to keep. And it's not business as usual anymore. You've got to make them feel like they're part of the team. They need mentored when they come out of mortuary college programs. They need a mentor. Not just tell them how you do things. You need to be there for them when they're asking questions. You know, get them off on the right foot.
That goes to, you kind of almost led in my next question. What guidance would you give a young professional just getting out of mortuary school, or even one who hasn't gone to mortuary school, and he comes into you and say, "Mr. Wiley, my plans are to go into funeral service." What advice would you give me before even going to school?
I like that question because I think it's important. I think a lot of states, their programs are backwards. I think it should be a requirement that before you can start a mortuary science program, you should have to spend some time in a funeral home working. Why would you expend that kind of time and money only to get halfway into a program or clear through a program and find out it's not for you? So when people come here, and I've had a few, and I'm always proud to take them under my wing. And my advice to them is, I don't know that I'm such a good teacher. Just listen. I work with a lot of other funeral homes doing embalmings. We do a significant number of embalmings here for other firms. And I tell these folks, just watch, be a sponge. Be a sponge of what I do, what the other funeral directors are doing. Pay attention. And it maybe not what I do is right for you, or the things you see from other people. But if you just take it all in, you're going to be able to create your own style. You shouldn't be like somebody else. You should be yourself. You should be genuine, and you should form your approach to meeting families, to embalming, what works best for you, what you're comfortable with. But to get there, it just takes time to pay attention to others, add that to your education, and that will help you find your way. You know, some firms have a employee handbook of things that they expect. And I've seen it a lot on social media. Some of the new people aren't particularly happy with some things that are in the handbook. But the problem is, the owner, the managers, this is the way we do things. And if the new people aren't comfortable with that, then I suggest respectfully, they borrow money, they buy a funeral home or build a funeral home. You lay awake at night trying to figure out how you're going to pay the mortgage, how you're going to pay the casket bill, the vault bill, how you're going to pay the withholding tax. Then you get to call the shots the way you want to do it. And I think, you know, when I was first out of school, I thought I was pretty savvy and knew everything. I was green as a gourd. When I look back, I'm thinking, why would anybody have put up with me? You know, time, failures, experience, it humbles us and it makes us better at what we do. And I'm not embarrassed to say I've made some horrendous mistakes in funeral service, and I learned from those. And if we don't learn from our mistakes, I don't know what to tell you.
What do you see that changes from the funeral profession in recent years, or even say from the time you start, the changes that have occurred over the year, and how it is impacting our profession and the families we are serving today?
You know, 30 years ago, if we had a death call, we would go to the place of death, bring them back to the funeral home and embalm them. It was just a given that I can't even tell you a percentage that this many, you know, a high percentage in the high 90% were going to be embalmed. You didn't ask for permission. You just did it. It was the norm. And cremation was just a very rare thing out here in rural America 30 years ago. And what I'm seeing now is things from a geographic standpoint are changing, especially in rural America. There's not a lot out in the country holding people here anymore. The young people, they go away to college and they don't return. And a gentleman that I buried made a comment one morning at coffee, and he said, you know, if you take a ride with me and we followed the route that the school bus took when it picked me up when I was going to school, he said, I can show you dozens and dozens of places where there used to be a family with four or five kids getting on our school bus. And now you go by there and another farmer has bought the place. They bulldozed down all the buildings. They're farming over it. So where there used to be a family living in our communities, they're gone. One farmer is now farming, you know, 8, 10, 12,000 acres, and those family farms are gone. So we don't have those young people repopulating. We don't have people forming roots in the bigger cities. You know, people are more transit. That changes their mind about traditional services. And that's not something me talking about embalming or any of the others that talk about quality embalmings and in care of the bodies. We're not going to be able to change the changing demographics, if you will. People just, as I said, they no longer have roots. They don't see the benefit of traditional services or body preparation or in ground or mausoleum tombs. And it's just things are changing. And whether we like it or not, we have to be mindful of those changes and try to keep up with those at some level, or we're going to be left behind. And an example of that is, you know, there are, and I don't mean this disrespectfully at all, when we talk about the some of these opulent cemeteries and these very, very nice, huge, fancy funeral homes, my question and my concern is, how are they going to stay relevant? How are they going to be able to maintain the financial footing that they need to maintain and take care of the overhead when we're getting a lot of direct disposers coming into our community? And maybe I shouldn't call them direct disposers, but people that just specialize in direct cremation. Now, when a big local funeral home, if their direct cremation price is, let's just say $4,000 or $5,000, now all of a sudden you have somebody that opened a cremation business in a strip mall, and they're advertising on billboards direct cremation $695, $895. The loyalty of people between that $895 and $5,000 soon fades away, and it's my concern, what's going to happen? You know, are we soon going to be talking to our grandchildren and say, you know, we used to actually embalm bodies and place them in a casket and had open casket visitations and funerals, and we buried in a local cemetery? It's not going to be that long, I'm afraid, that could be the circumstances, more so in the larger communities than out here in rural America. But times are changing. And so what we have to do as a practicing funeral directors that own a funeral home that have those types of facilities, we have to offer something that the direct cremationists don't offer. We have to offer some type of limited body preparation so that they can have an ID viewing or maybe an hour viewing for the immediate family. We have to go above and beyond what's on our general price list to take care of families, to keep their trust and to serve them and help them through the process.
OGR has and is, and I know they will continue doing a great job of being that support for the independent funeral directors. How can, if you could just spend a little time, how can we do a better job communicating with other funeral directors in our profession to make things better, that maybe be able to encourage other funeral directors to step it up? So, because if one is not doing what they should do, it pretty much affects all of us. And so what can we do to better be a better communication? Instead of looking at what we call competitor down the street, what can we get away from being that competitor, but being a completer? And I know this is loaded, being that we can talk better among each other to better serve the community as a whole.
You know, I just finished an article last night for the Yellow Book News, and I talk about that a little bit. I talk about incompetent practitioners, irresponsible practitioners, and the lack of attention to the embalming room. We are putting people in a place of responsibility where they have no education or training. They're making us all look bad. They're making mistakes. They may find themselves in litigation. And then you have irresponsible people who know what to do, but they're not doing it. And an example of that is, I've lectured in about 28 states, and I write articles for several state organizations, and people contact me for input a lot and for consultation. I recently had a funeral director contact me, and she said they received a ship-in. The person had been in a motor vehicle accident, lost an arm, and was autopsied. And when she received the body, the arm wasn't embalmed or reattached, and the cranial vault was left open. Now, why would you ship a body to another funeral home with your name on it in that kind of condition? We've become our own enemy. And whether that practitioner, that embalmer was incompetent or irresponsible, it doesn't matter. But, you know, there's a firm that will never be called again for a ship out. So I think when we have to look at what we can do to better serve families as things are changing. And you know, in my area, I get along pretty well with most of the funeral homes. We share equipment back and forth in terms of vehicles. I do prepare bodies for several of the funeral homes in the area. And, you know, when somebody makes a mistake with a body, here's the kind of long-lasting impact that it has. I was called one evening, and a young woman had died after a medical procedure, and it was an unanticipated death, and she was poorly prepared. But the person that reached out to me said there was a terrible stench. What it was a decomp. There was a strong odor of chemicals, which would have been like autopsy compound, because the lady was autopsied, and she had purge coming from her mouth. For those of you that embalm, how do you have purge coming from a mouth when someone's been autopsied? So the lady, who is a friend of the daughter, asked if what was coming from the mouth was a biohazard. And I said, well, it sure could be. And she said, well, the guy in the suit told us just to take tissues and keep dabbing it. I said, what? I said, is he the funeral director? And she said, no, I think he's just a helper. I said, you need to find the funeral director. And so the funeral director, actually, how embarrassing this is, he told the family that she was purging because the husband was touching and squeezing her arm, creating vascular pressure, and it was forcing the fluid to come out her mouth and nose. So I told her to tell the funeral director, I'm 3 hours away. I'll be there at 8 o'clock when the visitation's over. I don't know what the problem is, but I'm going to fix it for the family. An hour later, the friend called me and says, don't come. The husband just collapsed. They've taken him off in an ambulance to the hospital, and they've closed the casket. The long and short of this terrible situation was he spent 4 days in intensive care. He missed his wife's funeral. There was family on both sides, and it was shared to me at the family dinner that at the church, that my friend overheard that here's about 12 family members that said they wouldn't go back to this funeral home and that they wouldn't have an open casket visitation or viewing as a result of one person's incompetence and negligence. Now, if that doesn't resonate with people, if that doesn't wake people up, so I use Federated Funeral Directors, they could tell you monetarily how much that incompetence cost that firm and cost the rest of us. Think about 14 family members aren't coming back to your firm or our firms as a result of someone else's negligence. Shame on them. And he's not the kind of guy that would come to a conference and listen to me or anyone else talk about embalming because he thinks he has all the answers. I don't have all the answers. I'm not an educator. I'm not an expert. I'm just a guy from the country with a passion for embalming. Just breaks my heart to see the route that some people are taking us down. And once we lose a family, once they have a bad viewing experience, more than likely we've lost them as a traditional service family for our firm or another firm. And people just don't realize the impact. But I hear it all the time. See, I'm not far from Indianapolis or Champaign or Chicago, Louisville. We have family members coming in here all the time. I work our visitations when I'm here. And I just hear horror stories about how bodies look, how they were treated, that felt like they were just a number. They sat down with a pre-need counselor. That's what I said. They sat down with a pre-need counselor at need, and then they had to excuse themselves and go out and find a funeral director to sign the contract. And the family knew what they were doing. You know, that. You know, they skirted the state law by doing that. You know, they did get a funeral director to sign it. But when we make these, when the funeral director is not there with his fingerprints on everything, making sure everything goes just right, we start to see the dominoes begin to fall. Wow. You know, when there's not continuity with with the family, and they just feel like they've been passed around like a volleyball from a pre-need counselor to a funeral director signing the contract. And then they come in, there's someone else working the visitation, and then there's someone else there for the funeral. Families feel like they're insignificant and just a number. You know, some people won't want to hear that. It doesn't matter if they want to hear it. I'm just sharing the truth of what people have shared with me.
Do we have the time as a profession to get back to the basics that will make our profession great again?
That's a good question. As I said, I don't consider myself an expert or an educator. And I spend a significant time on the road lecturing. And I don't lecture because I think I'm good at it. I lecture because I think I share my failures. I share the things that work for me. And I'm hoping that just by being away from my family, away from my funeral home and the people that we serve, that maybe I can get through to just one person that will maybe make things better for another family. I know that that may sound crazy, but I'm just hoping to make some small impact and maybe help an intern, help somebody new in the business, because it's pretty hard to get through to seasoned professionals that have always done things the same way. It's, you know, at my funeral home, we try to make each service special for that particular family. And because of our location, we're able to do that. We've had antique tractors in front of our funeral home, draft horses, motorcycles inside. We do the helicopter in our parking lot, fertilizer trucks. We do things to specialize services for that individual family so that when they're with us, I want them to feel like they're the only people in our minds at that particular time and that they're getting something nobody else gets. And that's what we try to do here. And it's that simple for everyone to do that. You know, people dismiss and say, oh, you're just a little country funeral home. You don't know anything. And you know what? Maybe we're not, but each funeral is special and it's specialized for that family. You may be running 300 or 400 or 500 funerals and each one's cookie cutter. They're all done the same. The staff always does the same thing. They think because they're wearing matching ties and matching suits, that makes them a special funeral home. You know, that's all great. What are you doing for the families to make them feel special? What are you doing that when that family leaves your care, after they leave the cemetery, we deliver the flowers, what are you doing so that family feels like it wasn't a business relationship, that now they have gained a friend that took care of their loved one? That's how simple funeral service is, and we've lost sight of that.
I know you're a great embalmer, great funeral director, and you have a family. How do, and what's your recommendation on balancing family life and professional life?
Well, my children are adults, and my grandchildren, you know, they're all in school, and the closest one is 60 miles. So, you know, it's more likely we'd see them on the weekend. My wife helps here at the funeral home. And we're in a rural community, and most of the families we serve, we have a connection with over the years, or we know them. And so, you know, by working together, it's a double-bladed sword. You know, it's good and it's bad, but we take some time off. We go on vacation. We have a place in Florida. My wife spends most of the winter there, and I travel back and forth and just try to balance it out. Because to us, you may think, no, you're making that up. I don't come to work in the morning. I never go to work. I don't consider it work. There's some things that we have to do that aren't very pleasant, but I just don't consider it work. And I guess that's why at my age, I'm not talking to anyone about selling my place yet. It's just, it's something I still enjoy. I feel like we're making a difference. When Kurt Rosted asked me 10 years ago to make that first presentation, I had some photographs of some reconstructive work that I had done. And in order to use those photos, I had to reach out to those families and ask for permission to share those photos. And for me, that was the most difficult part of preparing for the lecture. And What is interesting is that some of those cases were going back over 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years. And the four or five families that I reached out to, they all told me the same thing. We will never forget what you did for us. Even though I was working somewhere else, they remembered it. One lady who was a biker chick, can I call him a biker chick and not offend anyone? She's a Harley girl, a little rough around the edges. And when I reached out to her about her husband who was killed in a foundry accident, I won't tell you everything she said. It was a little colorful, but she said, I'll never forget walking into the funeral home and seeing him look like he was just asleep. And she said, I want you to know how proud I am of you that they've asked you to share and my husband can be a part of that story.
Wow.
And I can go, all of the families that I reached out to told me the same thing, that what I was able to do helped them heal and that they were glad that their loved one could be part of a story or part of a training to help other professionals do the same thing. Now, see, that's huge. That's what drives me. That's what motivates me. I've done reconstructive work for funeral homes here locally recently. I had 18 hours in a facial reconstruction, and it wasn't going to be in my chapel, and it didn't matter.
Mm. The theme of our podcast this season is the changing consumer. So that the theme that we want to ask, with the rise of cremation, we just kind of getting out of the COVID-19. How has that impacted and the impact of cremation going forward? What do you see in this profession going forward for us as funeral directors?
Well, you're absolutely right. COVID had a big impact on things. We had people that wanted to choose cremation because they were afraid. And I had consulted with three chemical companies and came up with a protocol to treat bodies that were supposed COVID deaths, and so that we could have an open casket visitation and funeral for them. The thing that I think the impact that's been the greatest, and it still has a long tail that's affecting us, is when you read someone's obituary and it says the family has chosen cremation with a service to be held later. Do you know how often later never comes? You know, the sting of death is immediate. And that's when you need the support of your family, your extended loved ones, your community. So if you hold off, if you have a death in April and you want to hold off until July 3rd when all your family's in town, that sting of death has healed. Those rough edges of the broken glass, if you will, have been burnished by time. And you're not going to have the crowd, you're not going to have the healing impact that you would if you have these services right away. And that's what I try to explain to families. You don't need to be afraid of COVID. We're going to make things safe here. We had three drive-by visitations here at our funeral home, where we had the casket out under our carport. We set the flowers, had a carpet down, and a family was on each side of the casket. Obviously, the weather was nice and we're constructed so we could do that. And it went really well. But we were able to give the family something traditional in the midst of a so-called pandemic. And they still talk about it. You know, you have to think outside the box and get ahead of some of these things. We had a family that said, well, how could we keep families from embracing them and hugging them when they come into the visitation? So we set up an 8-foot table with a table cover with flowers and photographs on it. And the family was to be behind it. And you know what? We weren't 5 minutes into the visitation and the family was on the other side of the table, shaking hands, hugging, kissing. You know, that's what we're here for. The healing begins at the funeral home. Regardless of if it's a visitation with the body present or if it's a gathering of family and friends prior to a memorial service, we need to do it. We need to be more, not forceful. We need to explain to families that we're meeting with the importance of not waiting to do some kind of commemoration of that life.
Wally, I want to say that today, it was just an honor to have you as my guest and an honor to be able to talk with a film director that I'm so proud that you care. It's not a job. You love what you do. You're concerned about others. And it has been a joy of you being here today with us at OGR podcast series. We're going to be looking forward to seeing you at the convention this year. I personally would like to spend more time talking with you because it's a joy and an honor to have funeral directors that really care. And I know there's a lot of funeral directors in OGR and a lot of funeral directors across the country that really care. And it's people like you that will keep pushing and keep encouraging that will make a difference. And I'm strongly a supporting of us making a difference. And today I want to just thank you for being our guest today, and keep up the good work, and just keep telling the story. And I think that you will make a difference, because that's what matters. And so again, Wally, we want to thank you from OGR for taking the time to be with us to share this valuable information that you have given us. And just in your last closing words, you have anything to say?
No, it's just been a pleasure to be with you. And, you know, I'm not everyone's cup of tea. Sometimes my message gets a little strong for some people, but it's okay. I'm just telling it straight. And it's always a pleasure. You know what? When I do lecture, when I go, I have four lectures coming up in the next 45 days. I learn more at my lectures than I probably present, because I'm open enough to listen to people. People ask questions. After the lectures, people come to me. They show me photos on their phone. I'm truly amazed at the talent of a lot of people in our country that are proud of what they're doing. And I'm just pleased to be able to see that and know maybe I just have a little piece of influence in what they're doing. And so for me, it's a privilege to lecture. It truly is.
Great, great. And again, I want to thank everybody for listening in today on our podcast with our guests, Wally Hooker. And I again want to thank you for you listening to all of the series in our podcast. And again, to our community and to OGR for what they are doing, we want to thank each and every one of them. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the OGR podcast series. For more ideas on how you can better serve the changing needs of your families, check out our other episodes at ogr.org/library. That's ogr.org/library. Or find us wherever you subscribe to your favorite podcast. This episode comes from The Dodge Company, an OGR-endorsed supplier. Dodge believes in providing innovative products and services that create opportunities for its customers to excel.